Mr. Mayor, in June of last year, the staff came before Common Council and noted the progress on TIF 5, which was very early in its construction standpoint. At this point in time, the 2018 construction period is reaching substantial completion, and activity will decline but not cease in the upcoming months. So what staff has done is prepared for you a couple of reports or pieces of documents. The first copy that's included with this is a schedule of the expenditures that have been financed by the city to date by project.
Page 79.
At the top of the schedule indicates the original budget, which was included with the developer's agreement. The developer has indicated that certain portions of the contingency money should be used and has asked that they be moved from contingency to particular projects. Those have been listed here within the revised total project cost. You'll note that the total cost has not changed, but we've just moved contingency from contingency to particular projects. Then beneath that, the developer has taken 10 draws through the construction period through the end of November, totaling $14.3 million. So earlier in this evening, you considered refunding or refinancing $10 million of that, so we've spent another $4.3 million. And it indicates what's there. What staff would like to point out to Common Council is it won't be long, and the developer will continue to make monthly draws. And the agreement is silent as to whether or not expenditures for any particular project can exceed and then be, if they are not needed, could then be used on a different project. So, for instance, if the stormwater costs didn't need what was there and there was money available, could those monies be used for streets, for instance? And the agreement is silent on that. So staff needs direction from Common Council as to whether or not those funds can be used back and forth such that the full $22.48 million is available to the developer. The other thing that staff wanted to point out was that the developer's agreement had a timeline of various milestones which were to be completed. In June of 2018, staff pointed out to the city that the developer had received financing as required by all of those milestones. The one of the milestones required both the financing and building permits to be pulled for the apartment complex, and those building permits have not yet been pulled, even though we are several months beyond that May 21st deadline. So with that, staff is available to answer any questions that you might have. But this is primarily a report just to tell you a status report of where we are.
Alderman Mayor, then Alderman Nelson.
Are we anticipating those building permits? Is that something that's coming soon, or do we know anything about that?
They have not been pulled to date. Staff has been in discussion with a investor that the developer is negotiating with to construct those, but no, it's early in the in those discussions as to whether what's going to happen with that.
Okay. This new builder, is this a new builder?
That's a Milwaukee area developer of multifamily complexes.
But not the one that was originally going to build?
The developer, BPC Limited, was the original developer for those apartment complexes.
And so now there's a new one, and is that the cause of the delay?
I can't say there's a new one because there's no agreement yet. Developer has obligations associated with creating increment and back to the city if it's not there. As I noted in my report, staff has notified the developer that it's unlikely that the initial $20 million worth of increment that would needed to be there by January 1 of 2019 is in place at this point. And so likely the city will make a demand on the developer for tax increment that does not get received in the spring of 2020. The apartment complex are an important component of the increment guarantees on the part of the developer.
And so the developer is liable for those reimbursements to the city if the increment's not there.
That's correct.
Okay. Can we get, the rumor is that in the future they're going to be asking for additional funds. Can we get more clarification on this information as to when the permits might be pulled? And can we also get updates on any kind of, I haven't heard complaints from the area in a long time, but could we get an update on all complaints and the status of open issues between finance and planning and engineering at the time when that comes up for discussion?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Alderman Nelson.
Most of the things Alderman Mayor covered, but is this an open-ended time frame, or is there a certain point that we start asking, okay, now it's, you know, going to be March, when are we going to find out where you're at with the status? I mean, are we allowing them to have, well, we just talked that they don't have a developer. So, well, in 6 months from now, if they don't have a developer, are we still allowing this to go on just indefinitely, or is there any drop-dead deadlines that they have to make a decision on things, just given the amount of money that we're playing with here?
The arrangement between the city and the developer was that the city was going to make the site available for construction of increment. And so by its very nature, this was a situation in which the city agreed to put money up front to prepare the site, which again was a closed landfill north of Rawson Avenue, and that the site would be prepared by way of streets, water, sewer, all the infrastructure necessary to provide the infrastructure to provide for the development. The only milestones that were there were the milestones that were to occur, say, by the 1st of June of 2018. The developer has met all of those except the commitment to pull building permits for the apartment complexes. From early on in the developer's agreement, it was anticipated that construction was going to take more than a year, and so clearly the developer ran into some weather issues, and some construction has been delayed as associated with that, but I wouldn't say that site work is off schedule.
Okay.
They are where they would like to be.
In protecting the city's best interests, do you have any concerns at this point?
Clearly, when the developer's agreement was signed, finance staff said that the apartments and the senior housing complex was a substantial component required to meet the increment that was going to be needed to repay the city's money. To date, the building permit for the senior housing complex was pulled. That was pulled right after Christmas, so very, very recently. So that part, which is about $30 million in increment, has been pulled. But another $30 million worth of increment related to the apartment complex has not been pulled. And there are issues revolving around the financing for that construction, which remain unresolved.
I just want to get that out there so we start thinking about, because, I mean, when they're going to come back, if they come back with what was mentioned earlier by Alderman Mayer about perhaps more money, this is going to be a huge issue to protect the city's best interests.
Correct. The Common Council has a committee of the whole meeting scheduled for Monday night of next week, and one of the topics on the agenda for that meeting will be additional information related to the issues that we're talking about this evening.
Thank you.
Before we move on to Alderman Barber, one refresher of the point. If the increment is not there, and therefore providing the payment for the debt service, that bill goes to the developer. City's not on the hook.
Good.
Alderman Barber.
Most of my concerns have been raised. I would just like to state that I appreciate the inclusion of this discussion point in the presentation tonight. It gives us some background on it. I'd also like to follow up on that, or have staff follow up on that background point by asking the developer when and how. And maybe that could be part of our next meeting to have
Monday.
Some timeline on Monday to look at that so that my concern is that if they're falling behind at this point, does that mean other things start falling behind in the future? And that's a liability for him at that point as well, too. I'm concerned about where it's at right now, how we play catch-up and avoid this for the future payments.
Alderman Dandrea, then Alderman Mayer.
Then, Mr. Rosenberg, you made reference to possibly needing to use funds that are not used in projected totals. Is that going to be part of or included in our discussion on Monday in the meeting of the whole? I'd like to know when you are going to need us to give you some type of an action if we're going to provide flexibility with budgetary line items.
The budget was, I'll call it a soft budget, created by the developer's agreement, indicating that the developer put together a project cost enumerating components of the project. And that's what's listed on this page 74, I believe, of your council packet.
79.
Thank you. The agreement is silent as to whether or not underspending on one project could then be used for overspending on another project cost. The developer has been submitting monthly draw requests against contractor costs as they've been incurring them. And so, as you can see by this schedule, some of the projects are beginning to run very close to meeting the original project cost. And so if new bills come in, staff would need direction as to whether or not it's the Common Council's intention that the full $22.49 million that was committed would be available. So underspending in one could be used for overspending in another. The agreement is silent. So rather than take steps and then not be in concert with the Common Council's direction, we're looking for that direction to occur in the future.
And that's not on the agenda tonight, so I'll be the mayor and I'll say this will be on the agenda for the next council,
18th.
Okay, thank you.
Alderman Mayor.
Oh, I just want to tag on to what
22nd. Sorry. 22nd. I've been doing that all year. It's 22nd, not the 18th. I'm sorry.
Just want to tag on to what Alderman Barber said. Along with my comments, that was kind of what I was alluding to. If we could get some more detail from the developer as to when these permits and what the plan is. And it goes along with what Alderman Nelson was saying as well. We're not anticipating this going on forever and ever. We need some kind of specifics in this. And as Alderman Nelson mentioned, this is to protect the city.
Anyone else? Chair motion, please, on file.
So moved.
Discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. G10, we're going to talk roundabouts. Mr. Morrow, city engineer.
As you know, we decided to address the 51st and Drexel intersection with a roundabout. We hired R.A. Smith to do the design. 60% plans have been submitted. I include a couple pages of those in your packet. Full set is available in my office if you'd like to review the set that's submitted so far.
Can I?
You're welcome to, yes. I guess before I introduce Brad Severinson with R.A. Smith to talk about the design and the project, I will tell you that this design would take some property acquisition. We have some permanent property that we need to acquire from Payne and Dolan on the northwest corner, and then we have some temporary easements to establish grading on all the other corners. So after the presentation, I would ask that you direct staff to initiate the land acquisition process. And so with that, I'll introduce Brad Severinson with R.A. Smith.
Thank you. Again, I'm Brad Severinson from R.A. Smith, the project manager working on the design. So just going to briefly go over kind of what I'm going to cover here tonight. First, I'm just going to kind of talk generalities about roundabouts in the United States and in Wisconsin. And kind of why we came to the conclusion that we think a roundabout makes sense for 51st and Drexel. and then I'll talk about the preliminary design a little bit and then get into the schedule moving forward. So overall in the United States, FHWA has actually, so Federal Highway Administration has come out and said they'd like to see 1,000 roundabouts designed in the U.S. every year.
Did they offer a budget along with that?
like everything else, unfunded, I suppose. But, the reality has been, recent years, it's been about 250 constructed every year. Wisconsin is one of the leaders in the country in the number of roundabouts we're seeing, quite a few getting built more and more every year. There's about 3,700 in the U.S. so right now, and that statistic might even be a little old. I'm guessing it might be closer to 4,000 now. There is over 400 in Wisconsin. And again, that's Wisconsin's certainly one of the leading states in that regard. There's 10 right now in Milwaukee County, 2 currently in Franklin, 1 on Drexel near the Pick and Save and Target. The other one is on, Wheaton Way by the hospital. That one's kind of a little different one, but and the current one on Drexel by Pick and Save is a little smaller than we're looking at doing here, so I'll get into that a little further too. So why the interest? Why do we have these fundamental things, these circle intersections? Why we even think about doing these crazy things? Well, it really comes down to two things, the operations and the safety. It's been shown and proven very well that operationally they work just as well, if not better in some cases, as a two-way stop, a four-way stop, or a signal. Can handle lots of different traffic. They handle large left turn volumes very well. Safety is also the biggest reason we look at roundabouts. If you think about it, everybody in a roundabout's going slow. It's pretty hard to go much faster than about 15, 20 miles an hour. And yes, people make mistakes, but the consequences of making a mistake, blowing through a stop sign, blowing through a red light, that's when you're going to get your serious T-bone and head-on type of crashes where you're going to be a lot more prone to injuries and fatalities. And that's the biggest safety benefit of roundabouts, is it really gets rid of those types of crashes. So we really see the severity of crashes go down significantly. So just some of the statistics that are out there. First are kind of some national statistics. This is from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, and they're a pretty independent organization. They kind of feed data to insurance companies and their actuaries. So what they've seen is roundabouts offer a 72% to 80% reduction in injury and fatal crashes, and like I said, just the nature of a roundabout, those types of crashes are significantly reduced. It's pretty hard to get into a T-bone and serious crash because everybody's going slow. And they've seen a 35% to 47% reduction in total crashes. So that's counting everything, including your fender benders. Now, specific to Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin TOPS Lab in 2015 did a study of some Wisconsin roundabouts. So they looked at, I think it was a total of 15 single-lane roundabouts and 15 multi-lane roundabouts, so 30 roundabouts. So far in Wisconsin, there's been one fatal crash at a roundabout, and that was actually outside of not one of the ones that was in this study, but there has been one fatality that I'm aware of on Wisconsin roundabouts, and a long story, but there's some strange circumstances to that one fatality. But really what Wisconsin has seen, and to me is very important, is there's been a 40% reduction in injury and fatal crashes. But the next statistic, you might scratch your head a little bit, well, 12% increase in total crashes. Well, why in the world would we think about doing a solution that increases crashes? Well, a couple things about that number. First is the study, like I said, measured single-lane and multi-lane roundabouts. And what the study really found was of the 30 they looked at, there was a handful of really problem roundabouts that had a lot of a significant increase in crashes. Again, primarily fender bender type crashes, so they were still seeing a reduction in the injuries and fatalities, but those couple of roundabouts were really skewing the results and pushing it over, where the majority of the ones they looked at did have reductions in total crashes. The other thing that they found was the predominant crash types that they were seeing were failure to yield to all lanes in a roundabout. Well, that's going to be a problem that's unique to multi-lane roundabouts. The other issue they saw was people improperly changing lanes within the roundabout. Again, that's a problem that's going to be specific to a multi-lane roundabout. So here at 51st and Drexel, we're looking at a single lane. So some of those issues they were seeing aren't going to be an issue here, because we're looking at a single lane roundabout can handle the traffic. And like I said, what it really comes down to, what to me is most important, is you see a big reduction in the T-bone and angle-type crashes that lead to injuries and fatalities. So I could go into a lot more info about that, a lot more data out there. If you want to know more, the Wisconsin DOT website is very good. It's wisconsinroundabouts.gov. Lots of brochures, lots of statistics, lots of videos, instructional videos out there. So definitely would encourage you to go there if you're interested in more. So now specific to the 51st and Drexel intersection. So back in 2017, Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission did a study of the intersection. So I'm just going to briefly go over what they had found. So they found from 2011 to 2015, so a five-year period, they found there was 19 crashes. That equates to what we look at when we look at an intersection. This equates to 0.7 crashes per million entering vehicles. So for every million cars going through the intersection, there's 0.7 crashes. We usually kind of look harder at an intersection if it gets around that one crash per million vehicles. Then we kind of look, there's something going on here. I think there's a problem. So this was actually below that threshold for a five-year period. But there were three of those 5 years that we're at or above that one threshold where we start to look at something. So it's not a huge safety issue, but it's not, it is one certainly worth looking at from a safety perspective. But to me, the biggest concern on this one that they found was almost half of the crashes out there were angle crashes. So again, those are your T-bone type of crashes. That's very unusual for a four-way stop like this intersection is now. Usually what you see at four-way stops is you'll see a lot of rear-end crashes where cars are backing up, and it's kind of unexpected how far that's backed up. That's usually what you see. So to see an angle crash at a four-way stop, that kind of speaks to there's some operational issues. People are getting impatient. They're not waiting their turn. They're blowing through the stop sign. So it definitely speaks to operational issues. And I think at this intersection, that really is the biggest issue. So they looked at morning, afternoon, and the school release kind of peak travel times. So what they found is the existing four-way stop has what we would consider failing operations. We call it level of service, and that's level of service E and F. So it just goes through. A is great. You can flow through like nothing. You get down to E's and F's, that's considered failing. So those are delays of over a minute on average. So obviously at peak times, it's going to be even worse than that. So what they found by the design year, so we look 20 to 30 years out is kind of the design life of an intersection. They found that if you don't do anything, leave the four-way stop the way it is, you're going to see delays as much as 5.5 minutes in these peak times by the design year. So they also had a public meeting held in May.
Sir, could I get clarification on what that delay time means? I mean, the cars are lined up there for long, more than 5 minutes. And when somebody gets, if you're referring to when they get to the stop sign and then move on, I can't believe that would be 5 minutes. So,
no, that's your time waiting your turn at the stop sign, waiting in line, basically. How long it takes you to get through that intersection. Not drive through it, but the whole time, all the way from the start of when you're waiting in line at the back of that queue.
So are you taking into consideration the end of the school day when the line is half?
Yeah, obviously at those times. So I'm speaking, this is kind of average delay. So, yeah, when you've got those school release periods, yeah, those are probably even more than that. Okay. I don't know the specifics at what it would be at that exact time. But, yeah, certainly that leg at those times, I'm sure,
average.
Is worse than that. I'm talking averages over the course of those peak hours, kind of. That makes sense. Average of the worst hour, kind of. So not the worst delay you would possibly have, I guess.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
So that sewer pack study looked at kind of three main alternatives. So first was kind of continuing with an all-way stop, but adding on some turn lanes. So all right, what if we take this four-way stop we have now and we just scab on some right and left turn lanes? Well, what we found with that is it actually still has failing level of service, so still has delays that we would consider failing, even from day one. If you put those turn lanes on there now, we're finding that the delays are still what we would consider failing. And part of what happens with that, so you think, all right, we add turn lanes, we should be adding some capacity here. But what happens at a four-way stop with added turn lanes leads to a lot of driver confusion. You might get a couple vehicles waiting at that stop sign, but people still get confused. All right, whose turn is it really? And what you really see is people still tend to go one at a time. So you see very little operational benefit to that type of design. So next, they also looked at a signal, again, with added turn lanes. That did provide acceptable level of service out through a design life. Was more costly than the roundabout option that was looked at, and that's largely because first you got obviously the signal itself to install all that equipment, but also it required further construction down each leg for the amount of turn lanes that was needed. And another issue that we've heard is currently the city has no signals that are maintained. All the signals within the city are on state or county roads. So the third option that was looked at was a single lane roundabout. The operationally was expected to be about the same, similar to the signal, can handle the traffic with just a single lane. The biggest thing that the reason that came, I think, to the top was the expected safety benefits. Again, like I said, single lane roundabouts are shown to have overall safety benefits, but really what you see is a reduction in those angle type crashes and injury and fatality chances. And again, it was less costly than the signal alternative. So now I'll just get into the current design that we're proposing. It is a 133-foot diameter single-lane roundabout. So for comparison, the existing one on Drexel by Pick and Save is about 100-foot diameter. So this is about a third bigger. And what that really allows is better accommodation of trucks, buses, fire trucks, that type of thing. We're proposing a 24-foot wide circulating road, so that's the actual pavement going around. Sounds kind of wide. That's actually typically 24 feet wide enough for two cars, but with the radius that you drive around, that's a pretty typical width, feels pretty comfortable. Yes, there's physically room for two cars, but it feels narrow enough that people don't double up. It's a pretty standard width for this size of a roundabout. It would have, on the inside of that, have an 11.5-foot truck apron, so this is usually colored concrete that trucks' back tires can track over, and I'll get into that and show you how that works on some later slides here. So we have checked, and this design would accommodate semi-trucks for all right and left turn and through movements. We check it from to and from every direction, basically. We designed it to handle what we call a WB67, so that's a 67-foot-long wheelbase truck. So you're kind of the largest tractor-trailer size truck that you would see, because there are going to be deliveries coming to the school, so we want to make sure they can get through there. The path would the roundabout would have 8-foot paths in each corner. I'll show you kind of what those are for. We do have a continuous 5-foot sidewalk on the east side of 51st Street. That's existing. We would kind of maintain that, replace that where we have to, but that kind of maintains that existing sidewalk. And we would suggest installation of street lighting upstream of each crosswalk that lights pedestrians at nighttime, plus also makes the roundabout more conspicuous at night, that people will see it as they approach and know what's coming. So here's the design of it, the layout. Just go over some of the features. So this view is kind of facing to the northeast. So this is 51st. This is Drexel. The school will be kind of down here. This is the school's parcel down this way. So some of the features on here, like I said, this width coming around is 24 feet wide, where your normal trucks or cars would go. The red part here is your truck apron that trucks' wheels will track over. As I mentioned, we have the kind of continuous sidewalk along the east side of 51st, and then in each corner we have short segments of paths, so that if you're approaching on a bike, you can choose to leave the road and come on the path and then cross as a pedestrian.
We need an ordinance change. Don't allow bicycles on the sidewalk.
This would be considered a path.
Here we go.
There is some, I don't know if legality is the right term for that, but there is some, once you get over a certain width, it's not considered a walk. We would consider this a short piece of path. State definitions kind of would say that. So this, Again, these are shoulders, pretty similar, I think similar width to the shoulders that are out there. But if you were on a bike and were choosing to, and were coming to the roundabout, you can make a choice. You can either use this bike ramp and then, like I said, cross as a pedestrian, or you can choose to take the lane and cross like a normal vehicle would. As I mentioned, too, we would propose lights kind of upstream from each crosswalk to help light pedestrians and light the roundabout itself. Oops, had a video here, but it doesn't want to play it. Yes, no. Did just want to show this is just kind of a footprint of the trucks going around. Like I said, we did check kind of all movements, but this is just showing one of them so you can see how those, oops, sorry, the back tires. So this is kind of that inner curb, which is a mountable curb, kind of a rolled face, 4-inch high, pretty smooth curb. But so this would be the red truck apron. So you can see how the truck's rear tires would track over that red truck apron. That's what it's
headed. Semi right here is longer than the box is longer than our 102-foot ladder truck. Is that correct, or do you know? You don't know.
Then you're
our
this would be a 50. The box of this would be a 53-foot long box.
Yeah, well, that's going to be one of my questions when we get to that point.
That's got to be longer than there.
The ladder is 103. I don't know what the length.
The truck itself isn't going to be that. The
truck
right.
itself isn't going to be that. But yeah. My question will be, have you talked to the fire department and gone through this with them? Because the issue is going to be, one, the radius, but it's also going to be the sign location and the lighting location.
Yeah, absolutely. So I apologize. I have a video, but it isn't playing here. I do have a video of some fire trucks going through. But to answer your question, this is our check of fire trucks. And, again, we've checked those going through. Not a problem at all. That's actually smaller and easier to get through than the semi-truck. If you look at this, the fire truck, so this is a check of a 50-foot-long fire truck.
And I believe you, but have you talked to the fire department?
We will. We'll confirm what theirs is, but I'm almost positive it's smaller than this, actually. So we've checked a larger one.
We did give Chief Remington some similar size roundabouts that you can go visit.
Okay, yeah. Good. And then along with that, the sign locations and the light pole locations could affect the turning of the fire truck.
The lights will likely be set behind the paths on the outside, so those will be well to the outside.
Okay.
The signs are generally staggered, but they're too, they'll be set back far enough that any overhang won't be an issue. And as you can see on this, so again here, this is that red truck apron. The fire truck can make it around without even needing to use that truck apron. So it can go around just using the normal pavement like a regular vehicle does.
Okay. The ladder truck is going to be the longest vehicle that they have.
Yeah, we'll confirm those things, but I'm very confident that that's not going to be an issue at all, that what we've checked already is probably, I believe, larger than what you're likely to have. This is this particular one is actually one that we have from St. Francis. It's their largest one. It's a 50-foot one.